Dr. Pamela Tenertz is the Executive Director of the Clinical Trials Transformation Initiative, known as CITI, a public-private partnership of more than 60 organizations working together to identify and promote practices that will increase the quality and efficiency of clinical trials. I am Alberto Grignolo, Deputy Editor for DIA's Global Forum. As a result of her work at CITI, Dr. Tenertz will speak during the session Opportunities for Improving Informed Consent of Clinical Research Volunteers at the upcoming DIA 2016 annual meeting in Philadelphia. I am delighted to be joined by Dr. Tenertz and to have this opportunity to discuss these critical topics with her. Welcome and thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Glad to have you. And let me start with my first question. CDER Director Dr. Janet Woodcock once identified the separation between clinical research and clinical practice as one of the most serious problems with the clinical research enterprise. FDA Commissioner Califf, a co-founder of CITI, also addressed this divide in a recent speech and called for, quote, pragmatic clinical trials, end of quote. How does the work of CITI address this divide?
So this has been something that's been in our discussions for the past couple of years. As Dr. Califf was part of CITI, we discussed this a lot, how currently there is sort of a clinical practice piece and then a parallel research piece that duplicates a lot of the efforts and doesn't take advantage of information collected in the clinical practice atmosphere. And while long-term, we also hope that there will eventually be a learning healthcare system where we can learn from every interaction in the clinical practice area, in the short term, CITI is really focused on clinical trials. As we go to a more integrated system where clinical practice and clinical research come together, there still are issues that need to be addressed even as we go through that integrated system. So one of our new strategic focuses in our new strategic plan that was approved in April, one of the areas that we are going to be addressing is systematic evidence generation. And that would include using non-traditional clinical trial data sources and clinical and technical innovations. So we are looking at how we can bring those two spaces closer together for now, and we have a couple of current projects that are dealing with that. We have a mobile clinical trial program that is dealing with a variety of issues related to how we could incorporate technologies more readily into clinical trials that are for regulatory submission. And then we also have a project that is dealing with how can we use registries more efficiently in clinical trials, because registries typically collect a lot of clinical practice data already, and how can we avoid having to duplicate that and take advantage of those systems of being registered. So while long-term we aspire to this learning healthcare system where every clinical interaction can be used for research, in the short term we're trying to see how we can make clinical trials incorporate more of the clinical evidence that's out there right now.
How do electronic health records play into this new strategy, if they do?
Currently, electronic health records, I think there are issues that need to be addressed with that, and the OMC is dealing with some of the data interoperability issues. I think one electronic health record is not the same as another electronic health record. So I think currently there are still huge data compatibility issues that need to be resolved, and I think for now we are not looking at electronic health records and how to incorporate those into clinical trials, except maybe for some screening activities of trying to identify research participants, but really not really extracting data out of EHRs quite yet.
Do you have a horizon beyond which it might be possible to use electronic health records more productively? Is this related to there being more noise than signals in electronic health records at this time?
The main horizon has to do with data interoperability, and of course there is a lot of data is not the same as research data typically, and just any data, you know, there has to be certain quality in research data that is not always available, I don't think, in electronic health records. So I think the horizon is a ways away. I think ONC has a horizon of 2026 to sort of get to electronic health records being on the same page. So I don't think that's going to be for the short term yet.
Does CITI view electronic health records in the same category, if you will, as real-world evidence with the same limitations and reservations?
Real-world evidence is another one of those tricky things, right, because there's a lot of data out there that's certainly not evidence. So I think what we're trying to make sure of is that any data that's using clinical trials for decision making that that's of high quality. And however that is going to be done is to be seen. I do know that there obviously was just a new draft guidance put out on EHRs by the FDA. So I think more people are looking at that and trying to figure out how that can be done. And it helps, you know, the document, you know, gives some recommendations on how EHRs could be used as a source of data in investigations, making sure that the EHRs are interoperable with the systems that the clinical research investigators are using, and that the quality and integrity of the EHR is collected and kind of used is of a high enough caliber to be doing that.
Oh, thank you.
So I think the FDA is probably a little closer than ONC, and I think it might be, I don't know if it's a case of the tail wagging the dog or what it is, but different people are definitely looking at it. And it seems to be such a source of rich data that it'd be great if we could, you know, do better at incorporating that into our clinical trial data.
In the end, are you basically saying that there's still quite a gap between clinical research and the clinical practice that is not likely to be filled in the next year or two? Is the horizon longer than that?
I would think so. What I do feel is that while 3 to 4 years when I just started at Citi, we were talking about it, it felt a lot more hypothetical. It feels like more people are really trying things and making it work. So while the horizon is not 1 to 2 years, I think it's probably now closer to maybe 5 years. You know, it seems closer than when it was 3-4 years ago.
Let me move to a second question. What was the purpose of Citi's antibacterial drug development program, and what lessons has it taught us?
The purpose was really to help spur the development of antibacterial products in clinical trials. Over the last decade, many pharmaceutical and biotech companies had left antibacterial work. And it was sort of an equation of clinical trials being difficult to do, different resistance patterns in different regions of the world, diseases that are hard to, you know, sort of hard to investigate, patients that are hard to find, typical clinical trial problems that seem to be magnified in this antibacterial space. And then comparing that to the economic incentive for making those products was just not there as maybe it was in some of the oncology areas. And so many companies had actually, you know, over the past 15 to, you know, 10, 5 years ago, dropped their anti-infective programs. And one of the goals that happened with the antibacterial task force that was created at the FDA in 2012, they asked Citi to see if our methodology of doing our project, which before then was sort of more agnostic to specialty or disease, mainly working on general clinical trial process issues, see if our methodology could sort of help us forward in this antibacterial space. And what we ended up doing was a couple of different projects within that space. So it was a program that we started. And we heard a lot of people that said, oh, we've been talking about this for 10 years. What difference is it going to make for Citi to start on this? And we started in sort of three areas that seemed of the highest need. One was streamlining hospital-acquired and ventilator-acquired bacterial pneumonia. And the idea was that this was sort of the hardest of any of the infectious diseases to do a clinical program in. It was typically the last sort of step somebody would take in their anti-infective program if they had an antibiotic or antibacterial that they wanted to get to approval. People typically start off with complicated UTIs, abdominal infections, skin and soft tissue, and then move progressively into hospital-acquired and bacterial and ventilator-acquired pneumonia. So these trials were considered to be very hard to do, to be very expensive, and the idea was if we could help streamline those, then, you know, we would solve the hardest part of that particular process, but some of those lessons could probably be used in the earlier anti-infective programs that people were doing as well. Another area we tackled was specific with antibacterial pediatric programs, because we found that a lot of organizations had adult antibacterials, but then found it even harder to do the studies to confirm safety and dosing in children, and then looking at unmet need and what patients and providers thought of unmet need. With streamlining HAVVAB, kind of settled on two areas that we thought would be helpful to look at. One was sort of what are the protocol elements that make these trials hard? Like what are the specific things that we need to tackle to make these trials easier to do? And then on the second part of the streamline, you have that dealt with. If HAVZAP is typically one of the last type of trials people do in antibacterial work, then maybe we should be more stringent about not collecting everything. Maybe we can be a little bit more careful with collecting and at least making the data collection easier as far as burden on the patient, burden on the clinical site, and sort of decreasing costs that way. But when we talked to people in this space, the main thing we heard about is that enrollment is sort of the rate-limiting factor in these hospital-acquired and ventilator-acquired pneumonia trials. They were quoting rates of one patient per site per year. That is really, really low. Yes. And really hard to deal with. And that kind of contributed to the cost of these trials. We also engaged with us to do a study on what these trials may cost because we heard, as we were talking, people were throwing numbers around, but we learned that there were really no evidence-based reasons for those numbers. So Tufts helped us with analyzing what a typical patient in a HAVZAP trial costs and landed around, I want to say, between $75,000 and $100,000 per patient. And what we found is that the number is heavily influenced by enrollment. So that, you know, the more you would enroll, the lower that number would go, but it's true because enrollment is so low that it became to be so expensive. And then what we did is we also talked to coordinators in the space and asked them, why is enrolling so hard? And there's this one inclusion-exclusion criteria that seems to be the rate-limiting factor, which is a patient cannot be on more than 24 hours of a previous antibiotic, which when a patient is decided to have a pneumonia or display symptoms of pneumonia, patients have to be given an antibiotic within 6 hours, according to clinical guidelines. So you can't really wait, decide that a patient has a pneumonia, and then do the screening procedures for that patient because that typically takes longer than 6 hours. So patients are put on an approved antibiotic and then have to be switched. But if they can't be switched within 24 hours, then the patient is no longer eligible. So we had a big meeting about that. And one of the differences of Citi compared to some other organizations and other groups that have worked on this in this space is that we are a multi-stakeholder. Patients play an enormous, patients are equal partners along with governmental agencies, academics, industry partners, IRBs, and all the different stakeholders in clinical trials. And as we were talking about enrollment being a big issue in clinical trials, it turned out that our patients were asking us, well, why do you wait until we have pneumonia if we are at risk of pneumonia? And some of our patients in the room had said that they had pneumonia before and are probably going to have it again in the hospital. Why don't you talk to us before we get sick and actually have pneumonia, and maybe we can send earlier. So some of our recommendations will be published later this summer. Both of those projects, both of the streamlining have that project will be published. Landed on trying to see if we could do earlier enrollment of these patients in pneumonia trials and see if we could identify risk factors for patients that would have a higher rate of developing pneumonia. And so with our, one of the things we were able to do is to actually start a pilot project in which we are going to see whether actually enrolling, consenting a patient earlier at the time that they develop, that they display risk factors that then put them at much higher risk for pneumonia, if we consent them at that point, if that would allow us to increase the enrollment rate. And what we're doing now is doing a prospective study to identify whether our risk factors are actually then generating a higher rate of pneumonia so that if we can show that the risk factors are indeed able to identify those patients that are at risk, a next phase of our project would be to do actually a methodology study that looks at consenting early versus regular consent to see if we can change that ratio of one patient per site per year. And of course, if we can make that two patients per site per year, that would halve basically the time, the length of the clinical trial, which would decrease the cost tremendously.
To be sure. I'm intrigued by many of your comments, but one in particular I'd like to pick up on. Did you say that actually Citi interviewed or heard from patients directly in the context of this project? The voice of the patient was heard in the context of this?
Definitely. Every one of our project teams, I have four project team leaders, and since 2013, that includes a patient advocate as a team leader. So they are part of the project team lead. And then also the project team, patients are members of project teams. So on these particular ABDD projects, we have patients as a team leader and then also patients as team members. And this was during a conversation at one of our expert meetings where patients were sitting alongside academicians, clinicians, and governmental, FDA people, EMA people alongside. And in conversation, that's how this idea came up of maybe consenting earlier. And, you know, we really strongly feel that the voice of the patient, you know, is equal to everybody else. And we found in many of our projects that they come up with ideas that we might not have come up on because they live with the disease and they have insights that we just don't have sometimes.
That's quite inspiring, and it's great because, of course, there is a lot of discussion these days around how to involve patients in the drug development process and in clinical trial design, and it looks like Citi is very deeply engaged in engaging patients in the conversation.
Yes, we are, but we also really enjoy the fact that DIA is doing those fellowship trainings the Sundays before the DIA meeting, because I think patients, obviously, you don't want to put them in a situation where they are intimidated. So training patients on the drug development process and allowing them that background will make them really great partners in this whole endeavor.
Indeed, and I should point out that the June 2016 issue of Global Forum has a special session on patients with 13 articles devoted to the voice of the patient and its importance in drug development. Thank you. I have a final question, and specifically, what areas of clinical research are on Citi's horizon, and how can organizations like DIA contribute?
We recently had a new strategic plan that was approved, and in that strategic plan, we identified areas of focus, and so our areas of focus, which is sort of our horizon, the way you were describing, are things like a systematic approach to evidence generation that includes the use of non-traditional clinical trial data sources and technical innovation. So that's something we're focusing on. We have five areas of focus. Another focus is continuing our work on patients as equal partners across the research and development continuum. So doing more project in that area, making sure that we can help make sure that clinical trials are designed with a focus on efficiency and quality, that we help with clinical trials that address emerging public health concerns, which this antibiotic and antibacterial resistance work that we're doing really fits into. And then also looking at how we can make safe and ethical clinical trials that are also streamlined. So those are the areas of strategic focus that we're going to be working on. And specifically how that plays out is that we typically ask our Citi membership to help us identify topics for future projects, and our membership is just in the process of completing a survey where they are selecting topics that were submitted by steering committee members, by members of Citi. And then of those topics that have the most frequency, now everybody gets to vote on what top three projects Citi will be working on next. Another area of us to get projects is sort of FDA priorities, and so they ask us to do projects on occasion. But obviously the other thing we do is make sure that we are in line with other organizations, and we kind of interview our members to make sure that the issues they're focusing on as an organization are the things that we are also focusing on. And then obviously, you know, we always also look at the DIA trends documents and things like that to make sure that our areas of focus and the things we're working on are in line. And I think the same with Transcelerate, we're all sort of working on similar things. And sometimes it's a little confusing because we might all have the same title to a topic like mobile health, because I think Transcelerate is also doing some work in that area, but our work specifically starts after consent, and then Transcelerate is before consent. So we're very careful that while the topics may sound the same, we don't overlap with other organizations in the field. And then other areas that we've collaborated on, like with DIA, is the patient groups and clinical trials project, where we had a joint survey, and wherever that makes sense, that's how we will continue to work together with DIA.
That's wonderful to hear. I wanted to ask you about Transcelerate. Do Citi and Transcelerate sort of look at each other from a distance, or are you collaborating in any way? And if so, how?
We're certainly not looking at each other from a distance. Alvir Gill is on our executive committee, and we certainly have projects that are sort of close together. So we always make sure that we are connected. We have monthly calls with the Transcelerate project managers, and sort of make sure that, you know, we are complementary. And if they're working on something that we have previous work on, we give them everything that we've done so they can use that, and I think vice versa as well. So I would say we work, you know, closely together. as close as we can. Yes.
Well, thank you. Well, our time has come to an end. I want to thank you for sharing your time and insights, Dr. Tenert, and for all your work on behalf of the global healthcare community. Thank you very much for speaking with Global Forum today.
Thank you very much for the chance of talking about what we're doing and our opportunities to collaborate with DIA.